We shop, you save. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your price could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors. Not available in all states.
You're listening to WMCA New York. This hour of programming is paid for by the Talkline Communications Network.
Welcome to Headlines, Halakhic Debate of Current Events, a weekly interactive program on some of the most controversial breaking issues of today. Here now is your host, David Lichtenstein, founder and CEO of the Lightstone Group, and author of Headlines.
Good talk, everybody. Everybody has heard about the deadly Ebola virus that's continuing to spread around Africa. More than 20,000 people are infected, and nearly 8,000 have died throughout the region. I was approached recently by a doctor whose hospital is sending a legion of physicians and nurses to Africa, and he asked me what would be the halakhic opinion about putting his life at risk at some level for the purpose of helping to possibly save people's lives. Now, this is not just endemic to Africa, but it's a problem that we face in many areas in our society. For example, Hatzala members who sometimes put themselves at risk. I personally know somebody who was a Hatzala respondent during 9/11, and he got a disease. He inhaled noxious matters from the fire at the Kalal building. And ultimately, are we added to that? What's the halachic opinion? We have a special guest tonight. His name is Rabbi David Shabtai. He's the Sfardi Rav of the Boca Raton. He's a professor of medical ethics in Yeshiva University. And a gutvach, Reb David.
Gutvach, how are you?
A gutvach. So we'll ask Reb David a few questions, but before that, I'd like to make a disclaimer that I always make in the beginning, that even though we discuss the halacha, please do not use this program as a final decisor in any event, and don't jump on a plane and go to Africa to cure Ebola, no matter what you hear in this program. And additionally, at around 11:20 or 11:25, we will open the phone for call-ins. And the number here is 212-769-1925. So, Reb David, what is the halacha? If a Hatzala member were to come to you and he said, you know, I'm in a position where I would have to put my life in danger to save somebody else's. And it could be maybe he's responding to somebody who has some type of a virus that could be dangerous, or he was at a fire, etc. How would you respond to that person?
So I think I would respond the same way that we would probably respond to most halachic questions, that it depends. You know, it's an old question. It's new in that the Ebola question is new. But the question of putting one person's life at risk in order to save somebody else is an old question, and it's been debated a lot. And in all honesty, there are opinions on across the spectrum. There are some opinions who say that it's always forbidden to put your life at risk to save somebody else. There are opinions that say you're obligated to put your life at risk to save somebody else. And the mainstream opinion, which seems to be the most broadly accepted, is that it's actually up to you. And the reason is that we know that pikuach nefesh, saving a life, is one of the highest values in a Jewish scheme of law. Not necessarily the highest, but of the highest. We will pretty much set aside pretty much anything else that we can do in order to save a life. We'll violate Shabbos, we'll eat not kosher, we'll do whatever we need if it needs to be saving up to saving a life, except for the three cardinal sins. So the question is, well, obviously then, shouldn't I do whatever I can to save somebody else's life? If I'm willing to violate Shabbos to save somebody else's life, shouldn't I also put my life at risk? So the Torah also commands us, v'nishmarta ma'od l'nafshoseichem, that we have to keep our own selves healthy. We have to protect ourselves and maintain our own health. And so when you're discussing this question, it comes down to, well, does it really make sense to risk one life to save another? If the ultimate goal is just to save lives, well, maybe I should be obligated to save my own life. and before I put somebody else's life ahead of mine? Does it make sense to put my own life at risk, which might get me killed, in order to save somebody else from dying? And so most of the postgame are going to assume that, depending again on the risks and depending on the situation, that it's actually going to be permissible, but not obligatory. So many of the postgame will tell us that the rabbis of the Talmud never spoke about statistics. They never gave us statistical odds for things. They never said, you know, 1% yes and 50% no. So it's going to be hard to say, well, what's the risk? And is it going to be permissible or not? But everybody's going to agree that at a certain level of risk, a person is indeed obligated to do whatever he can to save somebody else's life. It's a very negligible risk. It's very low, maybe less than 1% or so, something approximately like that. It's something that people aren't necessarily worried about. And on the other hand, there's going to be risks that are much, much, much greater, that are clearly well higher than what normal people would agree to be reasonable, and those are going to be forbidden. It's that gray area in between that's going to be a little bit area of discretion for a person to decide. And one of the factors I think that comes up here particularly is that, well, who are we sending over to combat Ebola? Well, are we sending over, you know, physicians who know how to protect themselves? Are we sending over people who are going to use protective equipment properly? Do they know how to deal with this? Are we sending experienced personnel? And if so, for them, the risk might be a little bit less. They might be a little bit more seasoned. They might be a little bit know better what they're doing. And for them, the question might be a little bit different than for other people. So, yeah, it's going to depend on who's sending and what their considerations are and what they're ultimately trying to achieve.
Now, what would be the heter for a doctor to put himself at risk? I mean, he like everybody else, has the commandment of Hishamar Lecho Shmar Nafshecha Ma'id to look out for his own life, which is a lot. Somebody puts themselves in danger, is going against a prescribed commandment to heed for your own life. What would be the possible heterim that would allow a doctor to put himself at risk?
So, in fact, it's a good question. The Beis Yosef, so when he actually talks about this, he talks about it in the Beis Yosef, in Choshen Mishpat and Siman Tavkav, of the very, very last Siman in Shulchan Aruch. He actually says, well, he thinks you're obligated to put your life at risk to save somebody else. And he says a very succinct, Hu v'halav adai v'hu safek. This person is certainly at risk. One other person is certainly at risk. He's certainly going to die. And I can put my life at risk, but on the other hand, I might make it. And he thinks it's just an obvious logical equation that if I have the opportunity to save someone from certain death, that I'm allowed to put myself at risk to do so. I might not be allowed to kill myself or put myself into a case of certain death in order to save somebody else, but to put myself in a case of potential risk, that's going to be permissible. He quotes a Yerushalmi. He says, could the Isa be Yerushalmi? And he doesn't say where. Some of the posts can point out to Yerushalmi and Trumas that has the following story. That Rav Amy was taken captive in a city and by a bunch of bandits, and Rav Yonatan and Reish Lakish were debating what to do, and Rav Yonatan assumes that there's absolutely nothing to do. He says, Yikari Hames Bisvino. He says, well, we should get prepared for Rav Amy's Leviah. We should prepare his burial shrouds because there's nothing really we can do about it. Reish Lakish responds, Ad anakotil anamitkatil. Says, either I'll go and try to save him, either I'll have to go and kill them, or I'll get killed myself, and he'll try to save him. In the end, he was able to negotiate the way out, and they both came back alive. Many posts can assume from there you see at least there's a permission, at least, to put your life at risk to save somebody else, and we have a source for it. The issue of an ishmar samod nashoseichem, ishmar nashachem ma'od, to protect oneself, is to put oneself, those posts can assume, is to put oneself's life in certain danger, meaning I cannot kill myself to save another person, but to put my life at risk to only try to do something, the assumption is that would not be a violation and therefore would be permissible at least to save somebody else's life. Was that clear?
So let me ask you another question. Would somebody be allowed to, let's say, go hang gliding, or would they be over the avera of Hishamar Lecho Shmar Nafshecha? And If he's not allowed to because of that, so then we come back to the full circle again. We have two conflicting commandments here. On one hand, we have Leisamed al Damariecha, which is an obligation to save another person who's in danger. At the same time, we have the prohibition to put oneself even in a suffix danger, because going hang gliding is not for sure danger. It's the possibility. It's a high risk. So how do we balance these two seemingly conflicting commandments? Unless, of course, you take the position that hang gliding, etc., would be allowed.
So there are some who believe that hang gliding is allowed, and I think not only hang gliding, but skiing might come into the same boat with that. You know, skiing isn't certainly dangerous, but many, many people come back from skiing with more injuries than when they went out. And the question, again, I guess, would be one of balance. What are you accomplishing when you're skiing or hang gliding? So it's a form of leisure. It's a form of recreation. That's important. But we're not going to let you violate any prohibition in order to do that. To save someone's life, again, that's considered to be pikuach nefesh. And so, yeah, we're going to be a little bit more lenient with what we'll allow you to do or not allow you to do in order to do that. The same way that we'll allow you, we'll even require you to violate Shabbos in order to save somebody's life. We might even say, yeah, you have to put your life a little bit at risk to save somebody else's life. It's one of the earliest responses on the topic, one of the earliest tshuvos, is by the Radvaz in Egypt in the early 1500s. And perhaps what's most shocking about this tshuva is that he just answers it straight out. He's not shocked by the question. The question is that someone saw written out somewhere else. He's asking about a question that someone else was asked. That if an official from the government comes over to somebody and he says, well, I'm going to kill your friend unless you let me chop off your arm. So you have to let him chop off your arm in order to save the friend's life. And what I think is most fascinating about that is the Radvaz doesn't flinch. He doesn't even mention how terrible and horrible this is. He just responds. He says, well, look, every mitzvah has a cost. Whether that cost is money, that cost is time, or that cost is effort. Whatever we do has a cost. Everything requires us. You go to Daven Shacharis in the morning, it takes time. To buy an Esrog in the lulav takes money. Everything we do requires some type of a cost. The question is, well, how far do you have to go? How far do you have to go in order to perform a mitzvah? So he says, well, at first it might make sense. He assumes that it's logical that to save somebody's life, you should do whatever you can. So he assumes that you'd have to be able to chop off your arm, chop off a limb, chop off a finger, whatever it might be, in order to save somebody else's life. And then he takes it back and he says, yes, every mitzvah really has a cost. But losing a limb, that's too high. Losing a limb is simply too high. And therefore, that cost does not have to be borne by somebody in order to save somebody's life. And it gets a little bit complicated what his conclusion is, but it seems to be that depending on the risk involved, it's going to be permissible to do so. And yes, there's a mitzvah to keep oneself alive. There's the mitzvah of the Nishmar Samad Lashra Seichem, to keep myself alive and to do what I can. And when I'm risking my life to save somebody else, I'm not necessarily violating one of the three cardinal sins. For example, one of them is reticha, is murder. I'm not allowed to kill somebody, kill one person to save another. So too, I might not be allowed to kill myself to save somebody else. But that's only when I'm actually killing myself. That's only actually when I'm doing something that's actually physically going to certainly harm myself. And it's only a question of a suffix. When it's only a question of a doubt, then I'm not violating that prohibition. And indeed, to save a life, we are going to allow it in a permissible way, although not obligatory, because, again, you can't force somebody to take that risk upon themselves. According to most poskim, when the risk is somewhat significant, but most will allow it to go through.
Now, can somebody choose to be machmir and say, even though I'm putting myself at a very high level of risk, I want to be, you know, sort of lefnei mishuras hadin, I want to go beyond the letter of the law, and I am willing to put myself at serious risk. For example, in Ebola, they're saying that the chances are 8%. That, you know, the physicians could actually die. Does somebody have the right to elect to say 8, 10, 15, 20, I want to be machmir, I want to be, you have that right?
So that's actually also going to be a machlokas. And there's an interesting Sefer Hasidim. The Sefer Hasidim writes that if you're given the option that somebody needs to be sacrificed, somebody needs to be killed. You know, there's a group of bandits coming and surrounding the group and saying somebody needs to be killed, and there's an eminent Torah scholar that comes chacham among you, then you should step forward and say, take me, don't take the Torah scholar. Don't take the Talmud chacham. And there's a whole slew of not very mainstream postgame, would disagree, yes. In fact, you can give up your life for sure in order to save another person. Most postgame assume that that's not allowed. It's not allowed to risk one person's life, to give up your life to save another person, if it's going to be a certain death. However, many postgame will assume that it's also a question of numbers. So, yes, I'm not allowed to give up my life to save another person, but I might be allowed to give up my life to save a whole city, to save a whole nation, to save a whole country. They quote a number of different examples, the most famous of which perhaps is Esther. In the Megillah, Esther is pretty much putting her life at risk when she goes in front of Ahasuerus, and she asks to invite him to the party, and she even tells Mordechai ahead of time that everyone knows that if you show up in his court without being summoned, that he might kill you. So why was she allowed to do that? Why was she allowed to put her life almost at certain risk when her life wasn't at risk at all? And many of the Mefarshim explain that because she was there to save the whole nation, and that's permissible. There's a Gemara in Tainis that quotes a story about Pappus and Lalianus, that there was in the city of Lud, the daughter of the emperor, of the general, whoever was in charge, was found killed. And the assumption was that it was the Jews of Lud who killed her.
Of course.
There wasn't really a basis for the assumption, but that was the assumption. And they decided that they were going to kill all the Jews of Lud unless somebody would come and say that they did it. And Pappus and Lalianus stood up and said, yes, we killed her, even though they in fact did not. And they were killed, and the rest of the city was saved. And the Gemara then comments that a voice from heaven came down, a baskal came down, and said that in Birya Yochel Lamad B'mechitzasam, that Pappus and Lalianus reached such a high level of Kedusha, of holiness, that nobody can even come close to that. So we see that, at least in certain cases, it's going to be permissible to do that. So the question, when it gets to Ebola, is actually kind of complicated. Because most of the doctors who are going there are going to be treating a handful of patients, maybe more than a handful of patients, maybe a couple of hundred, a couple of thousand patients, but it's going to be on an individual basis. However, an argument could be made that, in fact, if we want to prevent Ebola from spreading throughout the world, and we do, the way to do it is to combat it in West Africa. That's the way to do it. It's not to wait till it gets here, wherever we are, and then combat it and try to stop it, because then it's already spread too far. So maybe an argument could be made that, you know, if we send people there, or people who are willing to volunteer there, they're not actually going just to treat the 1, 2, 300, 300, 400 patients, 500 patients, whoever they're going to see. They're treating them, but they're also, in fact, protecting their whole city or their whole world. And so maybe a higher level of risk might be appropriate. It's a tough question. I don't think it's very straightforward at all.
So why is it that in the olden days, and I was actually on mock-ups of the Nino, the Pinto, and the Santa Maria, and trust me, these are very small boats and very violent seas, when, you know, incidents of death on the seas was very common. Why were people allowed halachically to go onto the ocean? And you see halachically you were allowed, they were mesakin berchas agaimol for, you know, over a yam, over midbaris. We see that in Hilchos Shabbos, it is a long discussion exactly how many days before Shabbos somebody can cross the ocean, and Reish Mem Gimel, Reish Mem Dalet, etc. If putting yourself in danger is usser, why were people allowed to cross the ocean? Now, a possibility clearly would be that a possibility would possibly be is that to earn a living is different, and we're actually allowed to put ourselves at risk to earn a living. But is that the only way they were allowed to cross the ocean, is actually if it meant putting bread on the table? Or do we see from the fact that people were allowed to cross the ocean that putting yourself at risk was permissible? How do you figure those Gemaras?
So the Gemara I'm assuming you're referring to the Gemara about Metzia Kuf Yud Beis. The Gemara there quotes a pasuk from Devarim, Elav Unose Esnafsho, that a person puts his whole life into his livelihood, and therefore the Gemara wants to know, well, how are you allowed to pick apples from a tree, which requires climbing a tree, which puts your life at risk, that you could fall down? How can you do any number of different professions that require some level of risk? And the Gemara seems to indicate that from the Torah's pasuk, Elav Unose Esnafsho, there is a certain permission, there is a certain heter to put your life at some level of risk, albeit it's not the risk of Ebola. It is some level of risk in order to save somebody else. And in fact, if you look in the modern poskim, so the question came up with kidney donation. Can a person put their life at risk to save somebody else? And back in the day, kidney donation was much more a serious surgery than it is today. Today it's very different. So the Tzitzel Eliezer, Reb Lazer Waldenberg, wrote about it probably about 45 years ago or so, 50 years ago, even when this surgery was much more significant. And he thought And he was of the opinion that putting a person's life at risk to save somebody else is forbidden. Nonetheless, he writes that he wants to know right after that, well, what about a doctor just not going to West Africa but taking care of a patient in his own hospital who has some infection? He might have tuberculosis. He might have some other infection. And yes, the doctor will put on all the gowns and put on the mask and take proper precautions. But who allows that doctor to put his life at risk to take care of that patient? Maybe we should say, you know, I'm sorry, I can't take care of that patient. I have a responsibility to myself to take care of myself. And that same doctor has a whole floor of patients that he has to take care of. Why should he put his life at risk taking care of this one patient, which is going to prevent him then from taking care of the rest of the floor? And he assumes from that Gemara and Bava Metzia that there are certain professions that we need in order to have a functional society that require some level of risk, and that medicine is one of them, and that we assume that that's permissible in order to have a functional working society, that certain professions are going to have higher levels of risk. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any fire departments. We wouldn't have a police department because everyone can sit at home and be an accountant. An accountant is a very low risk, is a very low physical risk job, at least. And why is it permissible to have a fire department or a police department? And the assumption is that Sitzel Yezer of Usher White says this in a number of places, that in order to have a functional society, certain professions need to be taking place, and we therefore allow a certain level of risk in order to have a functional society. That would mean
so, Reb David, let's take the next caller. Let's take a caller, but if you'd like to call in, the number is 212-769-1925. We're speaking to Reb David Shabtai, the Rav of Boca Raton, and we're discussing putting your life at risk to save others.
Right, I'm listening to it.
Hello, we have a caller on the line. Hello?
Yes.
You have a question for Rabbi Shabtai?
Yes, I do.
Can you please go ahead? Can you ask? Go ahead. You're on the phone.
The case of the doctor seems to be very similar. The Torah talks about soldiers going to war, signing up for war and being obligated to carry through for those that are worthy of it. When someone goes to war, they volunteer or they're mandated to go to war, it's major for Knopashas. The chances of not coming back is high. They would often write Gittin because the risk factor was so great. The case of the doctor seems very comparable to that case.
And your comment, please?
My question is, most of your
Rabbi Shabtai, would you like to respond to him?
Sure. The question of war is an interesting question, because the question of war, none of the regular rules seem to apply. The rule of, you know, putting my life ahead of somebody else doesn't seem to apply. The rule of I'm not allowed to put my life at risk doesn't apply. The rule of the Gemara Bava Metzia and Tzemach Beis, that famous case of Rabbi Akiva ben Petora, that if there's only two people in a desert and only one container of water and only one of us can drink it in order to live, it's a very strange situation. The Gemara there says from Rabbi Akiva, Chayecha Kodem, I have to put my life ahead of everybody else. I have to try to save myself first. In war, the Minchas Chinuch points out that doesn't apply. In war, I have to put everybody else's life ahead of my own. So war is going to be a very, very different situation. In the case where the Torah is going to allow us to go to war, and it's complicated when we're allowed to go to war, that's going to be a different situation. Most of the posts assume that war is different. The question I think could be raised is, well, why is it different? It seems to be different because, you know, a war is somewhere where if I didn't fight this, then my life would be at risk anyway. So I need to take care of something right now in order to prevent, you know, ourselves from being killed. Perhaps.
Clearly one difference in war is the commandment to go to war is to put your life at risk. War is about putting your life at risk. So when there's a commandment to go to war, it clearly obligates us to put our life at risk. It does not obligate us anywhere to put our life at risk to save somebody else. So I'm not sure I understand that question.
Let me go to my next question. In the Ebola case, you didn't discuss what's the risk of benefit. It means what percentage people can they save. It means if it's an 8% risk to the doctor, what's the percentage that he's going to save the one who's sick? That should also factor into the formula.
Rabbi Dr. Shabtai, how would you respond to that?
I would respond that is a very, very good point, and I don't know that we have a good number for that. You have to realize that in West Africa, it doesn't have the best medical delivery system, and that pretty much anything we send them, people, personnel, equipment, is going to have a major, major, major impact on saving lives. And, yeah, saving lives is going to be highly, highly significant. But on the other hand, recognizing that they don't have a good medical delivery system, the rate of infection is so very high because they don't have always running water. They don't have good sanitation. And so it's very hard to know. But I think more than that, and I think the parallel then to war might be that we're protecting ourselves even. By going out to West Africa, we're protecting ourselves because if we don't fight the battle in West Africa, then Ebola is indeed going to spread to New York, to Israel, to every city where people live. And it might be considered that, like, maybe the parallel to war would be a defensive war, where, yeah, there's no commandment to go to war, but we're being attacked, and so we have to put our lives at risk in order to prevent that. Here we actually have
very
to go out and do
point.
It. It's a little bit
but
different.
See,
I'm not saying
my
it's
other
completely
question
parallel.
Is the doctor who goes there, you're giving a statistic of 8%. It seems to be missing what's the time frame that he's there. There's 8% if he's there for a week, a month, if he's there for 3 years. His risk factor is going to increase the longer he's there. So I don't see how any statistic could be valid without a certain time frame or a limiting time frame. I think we can agree that if he's going to be there 5 years, his chance of coming back are negligible.
Those are very good questions. Thank you very much.
I
would like to ask any other callers.
Our
number is 212-769-1925. 212-769-1925.
20 years, more than 300 of the Kahanim Gedolim did not make it out alive. How were they permitted to enter if the odds were so much against them?
Can you ask that question again, please?
The Gemara Yuma says that during this first base of Mikdash, very few Kahanim Gedolim, there were very few because they all survived the Kodesh HaKadoshim. During the second base of Mikdash, which was standing for 420 years, more than 300 Kahanim Gedolim died entering the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur. That means approximately 75% died. How were they permitted to enter if the odds were so stacked against them?
But the Gemara also says that they paid for the right, which is clearly not ethical, moral, or halachically. So we're obviously discussing a situation where halacha did not come to the forefront. I mean, to buy the Kahuna Gedola is clearly goes beyond the pale of what's contemplated.
Thank
so you're asking a situation. You're asking about a situation that wasn't, clearly was against Ratzon Chachamim. Thank you very much, caller. And let's take the next caller. I would like to again say our number is 212-769-1925. We have time for another one or two callers.
I'd like to ask your guest a question, whether there are any distinctions made between fighting in a war both as a volunteer or as a draftee. And how would you categorize the Israeli army, whether it was permissible for Jews to establish a state on their own, knowing full well that that would require a sacrifice and putting, obviously, one's life in danger. How and why would that be permissible, and what context would you put that in?
Rabbi Shabtai.
So trying to leave aside a lot of politics, I'm going to dodge the question and just be explicit, and dodge the question of the establishment of the State of Israel and how does that fit into this. But in terms of an army, so it would seem, at least I would think, that in order that an army is something that we're required to have, that every country is required to have an army, given the state of human nature, and that if we didn't have one, then we would be, the belief is that we would be putting our lives at risk by not having one. And so, yeah, having an army is an important way in order to protect our own lives. And so it's a balance again that we need one in order to protect our own life. But again, having one puts people's lives at risk. Is there a difference between a conscript army and a volunteer? Is that an interesting question?
Yeah, if I'm being drafted, then I have no choice.
Why a difference would exist?
Your question is what? Repeat the question. This point about being drafted. I'm not far following.
Meaning, if I'm drafted, obviously there's no choice. I'm required to go to the army if I'm a citizen of that country. But if I am not drafted, if it's an all-volunteer army, do I have an obligation to try to avoid army service because that's putting my life in danger?
So I would think it would come down to the same question of whether if you think it's necessary and can be accomplished otherwise. If it can be accomplished through other people and then you can step aside from it, then each person should, you know, should, in theory at least, could say, well, it's not for me, let somebody else deal with it, let them put their life at risk, and I'm not going to. The only problem is that if everybody says that, then we don't have an army. And so, yeah, you're going to have to find some balance between the volunteer and the conscript army, and maybe that's why some countries have a draft and some don't, because they have enough volunteers or some that are afraid they won't. But if every person takes that approach, then the whole thing, you know, the whole thing falls through. It's, you know, the same thing goes with elections. Everyone says, well, my vote doesn't really count. And statistically that's correct. But if everyone takes that approach, then nobody's vote really counts and then we don't have an election. So I think the same thing is true with an army. If everybody takes the approach of let somebody else do it, we'd be in a really bad situation. And so, having a volunteer army or a draft army seems to be, at least to me, you know, from a superficial perspective right now, not necessarily.
Well, thank you very much. And again, our number is 212-769-1925. We have Moshe on the line from Brooklyn. Moshe has a question about killing oneself to save someone else's life. Moshe?
Yeah, I'm in the air.
Go. Oh, you're on the air.
Thank you, Reb David, and your guest. I always enjoy the show, and this week was a special, your special guest was a fascinating show. My question is, I recently heard from Knesset member Yoni Chedbon that his mefaked in war threw himself on a bunch of bombs and through that saved the whole, about seven soldiers, I think he said. How would you present that? Is that a special situation because it's war, as you stated earlier that war is different, or is this a question like the Rambam has the Rambam and the other, the Machloikis, is if someone is allowed to kill himself for another mitzvah other than the three mitzvahs, or is this part of the three mitzvahs? How would you respond to that in halachic terms?
Well, I think the case you're referring to is, it was a famous case, Roy Klein, I think his name was, right?
Right,
and
yeah.
He threw himself on top of a grenade to save the lives of many others.
Right.
And I think Rabbi Shabtai spoke about that before, that would not be dissimilar to the case of Lunis and Pappas, that the Gemara says, Ein Beri Yochel Lamed B'Mechitzasa,
right,
that they did it to save many lives. Which is problematic, because we don't see halachically that a person is allowed, let's say, be Ma'abed Atzmei L'das, to save many lives. In fact, that the case of Esther, which would be the other case that would be precedent, the
right,
Lashon of the Rishonim, the Miri, the Ramban, etc., is it's Hatzalas Kol Yisrael, which you don't have in the case of Lunis and Pappas. Now, by the way, in the case of Lunis and Pappas that Rabbi Shabtai mentioned before, you could say that that's not really relevant to our case, mm-hmm, because over there they would have died as well. So since they would have died as well, they in effect did nothing by volunteering. They didn't put themselves in any exogenous danger that didn't exist beforehand. In the case of Roy Klein, where he would not have died, that presents a more problematic case. Is somebody allowed to take the Bima Abbot, in effect, commit suicide to save many? And that is clearly a very, you know, it's a difficult halacha that it's hard to bring a raya for. I mean, a possibility is that a person can be machmir again. There are shittas in the Rishonim that a person can be machmir, that's all as Yisrael, and actually, you know, what happens on a mitzvah where there's no din of a chai bohem, where there's no din of yerek val yaver, if a person decides that he does want to die. For example, somebody has to eat something that's unkosher, that halacha is v'chai bohem, he says, I refuse to. And it's actually a machlekes rishonim, what occurs in that case. A machlekes, the Rambam, who's machmir, but many other rishonim are mekel. So you're asking a question that really doesn't have an answer that is, you know, we could look at and say that's a definitive answer. It really goes both ways.
Mm. Would you say that it's a difference between saving one person or saving more people? Because the Gemara says that the Damach Sumach Tvek.
But on the other hand, we see that one lives in many lives doesn't make a difference. For example, if a city is surrounded and they say, give us one person or we'll kill everybody.
Right.
You're not allowed to give one person, even if you'll save 100,000 people. So you see that one life in many lives.
Don't
you know, something ironic about our religion is every life is considered an eternity.
Mm-hmm.
So what's a greater time span? One eternity or 10 eternities? What's more, one infinity or 10 infinities?
Right.
And mathematically, one infinity and a million infinities have the same value.
Right.
So it's an excellent question, and unfortunately, there is no real answer that we can. Okay, but thank you very much for your very intelligent call. Again, our phone number here for call-ins is 212-769-1925. I would like to mention, Rabbi Shabtai, a very interesting tshuva that's brought by the Mude Esh, and he says that in Hungary, people used to volunteer. People who were called up for service, other people would be able to pay others to go in their place and put themselves at risk. And he said this was an accepted tradition in all of Hungary. Okay, I see we have here another caller. Can we put the next caller through?
Please lower your radio.
Who is it? Do we have a caller on the line?
Please lower your radio. Hello?
Okay, we seem to have lost that caller. But are you, Rabbi Shabtai, are you familiar with the halacha that I'm talking about?
You were cut off for a moment, but I think I heard you talking about paying somebody else to join the conscript army instead of yourself.
Yes, so there's a tshuva from Imre Yesh. He says, in Poland and Hungary, when a person was drafted, you were allowed to have somebody go in your stead. They just wanted a body. And there were people, basically mercenaries, who would rent themselves out for a certain amount of money and say, I'll go in your stead, so you do not have to go, even though they were clearly putting themselves at risk. And he says, the chances of dying were 16%. And he brings a raya from the Gemara in Shavuos, that a person can go join the army even though there was a greater than 16% chance of death. And he says that was the tradition in all of Hungary and Poland. So, which is quite an interesting Gemara. Now, a possibility again there is that to earn a living, you are allowed to put yourself at risk. Which is the Gemara that you mentioned before. Alechu naisi asnafshe. I mean, let's face it, a lot of people, you know, fly to the furthest ends of the world, etc. There's actually, I believe, a Noi de Yehuda that discusses if a person wants to earn a living hunting, can he or not? And he says you can, because putting your life at risk to earn a living is something that's accepted. So would you say that a doctor maybe would have a greater reason to be able to do this than a Hatzalah member, because a doctor actually is doing this to earn a living?
That's very interesting. Um, I would just guess on a regular basis that Othello members probably practically put themselves at higher risk than most doctors because they're attending accident scenes and they're, I mean, I also know people who responded on 9/11 and I know many of them didn't even think twice. This was second nature to them and they were called, the bridges and tunnels were shut down, every ambulance in Manhattan went down to do whatever they could do. Whereas the doctors sort of see things in a much calmer perspective in the hospital. Hospitals don't seem very calm, but it's not an accident scene. And so I'm going to guess on the average day, a hotel member probably puts themselves at a higher risk than the average doctor. Would it make a difference if it was able to not see a hospital? It would probably allow a certain level of risk, but whatever level of risk that the hotel members are taking and everything they're doing is in consultation with Postkim and they've talked about these things and worked out all these issues. I don't know that it would be that much greater, a level of risk greater, but yeah, based on that Gemara Bava Metzia, perhaps they would have a little bit more of a leeway. But on the other hand, and there might be the question of volunteering, that a volunteer who opts to do something may have more of a right to do it based on maybe Pavos Malianos, who maybe they were also from doesn't actually indicate that they were from the city of Lod. Most people assume they were from the city of Lod. But maybe volunteering to do something gives you a little bit more of a leeway. In that case of the Tosef and Trumas that you mentioned, if a city is being surrounded and they say, well, give us somebody. So the psak is clearly that we're not allowed to give anybody over. And Yehargu Kulam, Volume 7, Nefesh Ahas Meisrael, that we allow the whole city to be killed because, again, the one infinity is not greater than 10 infinities. Some of the posts can discuss, well, what if somebody volunteers and gets up and says, I'll do it? And some of the postkim seem to indicate that maybe there would be more room for that. So there could be more room to differentiate between a volunteer and a salaried worker.
Okay, I think we have time for one more caller before we say we've thanked Rabbi David for being online with us, but we do have time for one last call. So let's hear our a last caller before we sign off for the night.
Hi, Shavua Tov. So my question is, when you talk about saving a life, are you differentiating between a Jewish life and a non-Jewish life or not? Hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah, Rabbi Shabtai, would you like to respond to that? Thank you very much. This is Ginger, is that correct?
Right, yes, Shavua Tov.
Yes, okay. Shavua Tov. Rabbi Shabtai?
So I think for all practical purposes that all modern-day postkim assume that practically we do not differentiate. Practically speaking, we when it comes to saving a life, we save a life. A doctor who's called to a hospital doesn't ask the religion of the patient on Shabbos, for example. He doesn't drive when he has to drive to the hospital on Shabbos to take care of a patient, he does not ask the religion of the patient before he gets there. When a hotel is given a call, you know, in many areas, Hatzalah comes faster than 911. And so when Hatzalah gets a call on Shabbos, and Hatzalah gets a call ever, and it requires them to do whatever it needs to require, they don't care. They take care of every single patient because that's what they need to do. And that's not just because people don't care. That's not just PR. That's how the halacha is decided, is that we do take care of everybody no matter what.
Oh, and so okay, that's wonderful. And what about in a situation like Ebola, going to Africa? Same thing.
Going to Africa, again, is taking care of, I'm going to assume that the Jewish population of West Africa is not very high. So I'm going to assume that they're taking mostly care of non-Jewish patients, and the same considerations would apply. In addition, I think that I think it's a valid argument that if we don't fight Ebola in West Africa, then we'll be fighting Ebola in our backyards, and then it'll be affecting, you know, our families and our neighbors and ourselves. So maybe it's a little
Well, thank you very much, Ginger. Rabbi Shabtai, you have time for one more caller?
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, so we have Maisha on the line from Brooklyn. Go ahead. You're on the line, Maisha. What's your question?
Yes, and this shiloh was the right to have had during the war when a father wanted to switch with his child that was taken by the Nazis about to get executed. And Vaitulov had to think of what, I'm forgetting what the answer was, but I think the father said, listen, my son is, it was a whole shine of which if he can switch with his son when the Nazis, by the Nazis.
And what would be your question, Maisha?
No, the Shiloh was when the Nazis had somebody, they were killing somebody, and whether somebody could switch at that time was guaranteed death.
So he's referring to a case which is, can somebody save their own life when they know that it will put somebody else's life will be taken in its stead? So it's not really exactly on line with what we're speaking about, Rabbi Shabtai. Do you have any thought about that question? Well, it's somewhat relevant because if we assume that a person is putting themselves at great risk, like a doctor is, so does he have the right to, you know, in effect, he may save one life at the risk of his own life. And that, he says, that was a question where in the time of World War II, a person could save themselves, but they knew that if they saved themselves, another person would die in their stead. And that was, he says, a question of the Weizen Rebbe. Bishop Tai, do you have any thoughts on that?
So if I'm not mistaken, it's a tshuva in the Tshuvas Mima'amakim by Rav Ushri, who has this tshuva, and I think he says it's not allowed.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he says it's not allowed, and the reason is you can't substitute one for another. I can't give up my life to save somebody else, according to most, according to everybody. I'm not allowed to put myself at certain death in order to save everybody else, and volunteering for the Nazis would have been certain death. And that would be, it's different than saving Klal Yisrael, it's different than saving a whole nation or a whole city. It's a one for one, and that would certainly be forbidden.
And do you think, let's say, when you release, you know, terrorists in exchange for freeing a soldier, and knowing that there's almost a certainty if you release 1,000 terrorists, that one of them will kill somebody else. Do you think that rises to the same question? In effect, you're trading one life for another. And if that's the case, would it be problematic then to exchange 1,000 terrorists for one soldier?
I think it's an interesting question. I think it's certainly one of the factors that has to be taken into consideration, that we know when we release certainly 1,000 terrorists that someone is going to come back, statistically speaking, and do something terrible, and I think we have experience that that's been true. I think the other side, unless I don't know which side should prevail here, but the other factor to take into consideration is the morale of your army. If all of your soldiers know that you will do everything in order to bring them back, they might be willing to fight better. They might be willing to give everything they have. They might be willing to take an extra risk. They might be willing to take that extra step when they're still on our side. Because they know that no matter what happens, we're going to do everything we can to get them back. And so I don't know how you balance these things. I don't know how you balance the risk of another terrorist attack versus the morale of your army. But I think it's the same factor coming in on both sides. Are you really risking one life for another? And whose life are we risking? And what are we gaining from it? But it's definitely one of the factors.
So I would like to thank our guest, Rabbi David Shabtai, the Sfaradi Rav of Boca Raton. He's also he's also an MD and professor of medical ethics at Rishivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. Thank you very much, Rabbi Shabtai, for your enlightening words. I would like to close off with all thought on the Parsha and a few questions from my audience. Why is it the first two brothers to get along in all of Sefer Bereishis are Menashe and Ephraim? What did Yosef do that allowed his children to live in harmony, whereas all the families that preceded him were not able to accomplish? That's question one. And the second question is, Yosef is the most successful person, possibly in the Torah, certainly in Sefer Bereishis. What secret did Yosef have that allowed him to have such great success? Now allow me. If you look at Sefer Bereishis, it starts with the story of Cain and Hevel, of Cain and Abel. What happens? We have two brothers, jealousy. One sacrifice is accepted, the other sacrifice is not accepted. What does he do? He rises and he kills his brother. Fratricide. A hideous act. Interestingly, where are Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, while this is occurring? They're nowhere to be found. The two parents, we don't find nearly a word. One of their children was killed by the other. Possibly. Being that they're the first parents who ever
They had no idea how to react. Maybe the law of the jungle applies to families too. We see the first child of the child of Cain is called a Chanoch. Chanoch means educated, cultivated, brought up. Why is that? Because Cain and Hevel, their parents had no idea how to relate to them in adolescence, as teenagers. Adam and Chava never had an adolescence. Cain and Hevel did. So the first child to actually have an adolescence and had a parent who say, hey, I went through that and I know how to react, were Cain and Hevel, was Cain, and therefore he named his kid Chanoch. But Cain and Hevel were a very bad example. Look at the next children in the Torah, Noach and his sons. One of the sons does a hideous act, and what happens to, how does Noach react? The child is anathematized, he's cursed. Eved Avadim, caste system. He becomes a slave to his own brothers. Not exactly a good outcome. The next set of brothers we have are Yishmael and Yitzchak. And what happens there when Yishmael's behavior is not exemplary? Banishment, garish asam azais, exile, banishment. Not a good outcome. The next children are Yaakov and Esav, the children of Yitzchak. What happens? Esav tries to kill Yaakov. He sends soldiers to, sends his children to kill him. Not a good outcome. Yosef and the Shvatim, well, first they try to kill him. And afterwards, Yehuda says, Ma betza. And he says, what profit would there be from, could we get from killing him? So he's sold into slavery. Family after family, five different brothers in the Torah that precede him, all of whom, no accord, no harmony. The children of Yosef get along. Why is that? And let me suggest an answer. When Yaakov benches Ephraim and Manasseh, he crosses his hands in this week's parasha, Sichelus Yadav. Now, Yosef knows what favoritism can do to a family. I mean, doesn't the Gemara say, La'olam al yishana adam b'nai al banav shal b'shol snei slayim, for the two shkalim that he gave Yosef, his multicolored garment, look at all the hatred it incited. Yosef is sitting there, and he sees this favoritism, and he's been a victim of it. And what does he do? He looks at his father, and he uncrosses his father's hands, and he says, Lo chein avi, father, this is not how we do it. We don't apply favoritism to children. And Yosef changes the narrative in his family forever. There is no more favoritism. Generation after generation of discord has been stopped by him changing the narrative and saying, Lo chein avi. And he doesn't just change the narrative with his children. He changes it with his brothers too. When his brothers come to him and they say, after his father's death, we'll be your slave. They were petrified. What does he say? Al tiro, fear not. I will feed you. He changes the narrative, not only for his own children, but in the relationships. Whereas the brothers, think of the nekama, think of the vengeance that Cain and Hevel, Esav, Yishmael, and he says, no, 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 no more vengeance. We're done with that. The narrative is over. In fact, the next two brothers we see are Moshe and Aaron. And even though Moshe was the younger brother, but he rose to far greater heights than Aaron, Aaron still loved him, Barav Samach Belibai, because Yosef changed the narrative forever. And this is relevant to us because we are all children of Yosef. We are called She'eris Yosef. And that means that in our DNA is that power to change the narrative in our own lives. You know, we could say, you know, my father had a temper, my grandfather had a temper, my great-grandfather, so I have a temper. We can become victims of the past and assume that yesterday has to dictate what our tomorrow looks like. But Yosef says, no, we have the ability to change that narrative.
If our parents did not necessarily bring us up in a way that we understand and that maybe caused us pain, we don't have to have our children's relationships with us to be a continuance, to be a mimeograph of the ways we were brought up. Yosef empowers every single one of us to say, Lo chein avi, the buck stopped with me. I will not continue any type of this discord. Now, where does Yosef get that power from? Where does he get that? The second question was, where does he get this success from? I think it's part of this. When he names his two children, he names his first child Menashe. What does Menashe mean? Nashani Elokim. God allowed me to forget all the travails and anguish from my parents' home. And he names his next child Ephraim, fruitful, and God allowed me to become fruitful in the land that I sojourned to. So I have a question. Why did he name the first child Menashe and the second child Ephraim? Why didn't he do it in the reverse order? Name the first child Ephrani, fruitful, and the second child Menashe, I was blessed to be able to forget the pain of my childhood home. And I put to you that the ability to forget the pain of the past is what allows us to move forward and be fruitful in the future. Nobody struggled as much as Yosef in the Torah. Nobody had the hideous events that happened to him. Hatred. He's the first person who's molested in the Torah as a slave. A 17-year-old slave by the owner's wife. That's molestation. And then he's framed by her. But what does he say? I moved on. Nashani, I forgot. And Nashani becomes before Hifrani. Because before you could be fruitful, you have to be able to let go. So Yosef is always letting go. You know, this year was New Year in most of the world. The Gregorian calendar celebrated New Year. And our New Year is very different. Here it's New Year of the Gregorian calendar is popping champagne, parties, resolutions, none of which last. The biblical New Year, the Jewish New Year, is about forgiveness. Slicha u'mechila. Why do we start the New Year with forgiveness, with letting go? And I put to you, you can't create a new tomorrow if you're holding on to yesterday. You can't run a race carrying a heavy package on your back. So first we have Slicha, Mechila, and Kapara, and after that we can have a new year. First we have to have Nashani before we could have Hifrani. Do you know that the Baal Shem Tov had a very special minig, that every Friday night they would eat farfel, farfali, the pasta, which also means let bygones but be bygones. So let's each and every one of us eat farfel every Friday night, say goodbye to all discord, disharmony, and let's make enmity, into courtesy and civility. And by doing that, we will be able to move on and be successful just as Yosef was. Thank you very much. Next week we'll have Rabbi Ari Marburger of the Lakewood Beis Din, and the topic will be Madoff. Do yeshivas that got money or buildings from somebody like him have to return it? A gutavach. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Headlines, Halakhic Debates of Current Events with David Lichtenstein, founder and CEO of the Lightstone Group and author of Headlines. Please join us again next week for another edition of Headlines.
TCN, Talkline Communications Network Radio, America's number one Jewish program.
If you are enjoying tonight's radio show, please make sure to read David Lichtenstein's important and innovative new book of the same title as this broadcast, Headlines, Halakhic Debate of Current Events, published by OU Press. embark on a fascinating journey through Halakha on some of the most important and controversial breaking issues of the day. Available at your local Jewish booksellers and at Amazon.com.
A service of Salem Communications. Mike Connors, host of Ask the Lawyer and published in New York Magazine's top-rated lawyers. Whether assisting a client with drafting a will or trial.